This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
It is time for the Aftershock Central Podcast. That's right. We're still here. Ronnie and I got the chance to go to C2E2 this past weekend, and Aftershock had an awesome panel. I thoroughly enjoyed meeting all the creators that were there. Let's see. Donnie Cates from Baby Teeth was there. Adam Glass from Rough Riders of the Normals. Phil Hester from Shipwreck and Blood Blister, and of course Joe Pruitt was there, and had a really good time. The panel was great. Everyone was super personable, and thoroughly enjoyed what they had to say. So here's the panel. We will be coming back with regular episodes again beginning next week. Hope you enjoy. You can find us all on Twitter, at Jack Sutherland, at Ronbar316, at Geekvine, at Aftershock Pod. And be sure to check out the Aftershock Facebook group as well. Enjoy the show. We'll catch you next time.
All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Aftershock panel here at C2E2 2017. We're going to start things off. Actually, we've got a short sizzle highlighting all of our past, current, and upcoming titles. And so hope you enjoy it.
Joe works his kids really hard.
I
just want to point out now, so we have some really exciting guests on our panel. My name is Mike Zagari, I'm SVP brand for Aftershock. Each one of these amazing creators are going to get their own slide and a lot of time to chat with you guys. We want to just mention right off the bat that we are really excited because about 2 years, Joe, can I remember, about 2 years we announced.
2 years ago this month we announced the company.
Yep. So we've got a little bit of an anniversary coming on here, and we just want to point out to all of you that, you know, we're really excited that we're in this for the long term, and we appreciate your support because, you know, we're all about making high quality, and again, these guys are going to go into a lot more detail about the awesome series that we're working on. And that's what we'll do. We'll kick things off with Mr. Donnie Cates right here.
Hey. So Baby Teeth, this is this weird new book that we're putting out in June. I also did those other two books, but we're not going to talk about those. Baby Teeth is a book that comes out in June. It's an ongoing. It's about a 16-year-old girl who gives birth to the Antichrist. But it's like far and away the sweetest, kind of nicest book I've ever done. Those two other books over at Image, and both of those are about like old men with Alzheimer's and like a bunch of old scraggly rednecks and stuff like that, right? And I kind of got it in my head that I wanted to write something that was nice and full of love and sweet. And I suppose it's very telling that my idea of that is the Antichrist. We're having a blast. Like, Gary Brown's drawing it for us. Mark Englehart? Is that how you say his name? Yeah. Is coloring for us. He did Shipwreck as well. It's fantastic. We have a few super duper secret covers that are only on my iPhone that I could probably be talked into showing you at the booth.
Just hold them up
like this. And to that point, I'll actually be at the booth right after this is over, signing things as well, if anybody wanted to come by. So yeah, that's baby teeth. I only have to explain books for so long to get it across. Baby teeth is like the easiest one. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. I've been having a blast doing it.
Yeah, so just to add a little bit more on Baby Teeth and Donnie, we're so happy to have him part of the team. This is just an amazing book, and we're so excited for the launch. And actually, we actually shared with retailers a full watermarked preview, and we already heard back from a lot of the retailers, and one of them actually said, not only is it Donnie's best book ever, they said it was the best thing they've read all year. So that's, you know, I'm not paraphrasing, that was exactly what they said, and hey, it's a retailer, but we're excited for the launch, and if you come back to the booth, Donnie's going to be signing, yeah, as well as there might be some other special treats for you guys that are Baby Teeth related. So, yeah, a lot of fun.
And there's a hell raccoon in the boat. It's like a raccoon from hell. It's in the boat. It's pretty tight. It's like a bunch of assassins and stuff.
Can you describe how the raccoon shows up? I like it.
Well, I don't want to spoil that aspect because that's an issue 3 drop. But
okay.
I will say our esteemed I don't even know what to call him. He wears so many hats. Mike,
editor in chief,
slash everything, slash lawyer, does everything. Mike Martz. So apparently, Mike. So I turned in this outline for this thing, and I knew there was going to be this hell raccoon, this like weird little creature from hell, who ends up becoming the baby's first pet. Because this hell raccoon like sniffs it and realizes like, oh, this is the king of the dark world, and becomes its like little pet and everything. And when I was writing the outline, I wrote hell raccoon as like a placeholder term for whatever the hell this creature Gary ends up making. And apparently, unbeknownst to me, like Mike Martz has like a really weird thing with raccoons.
I say wonderful.
You know, like he has like an odd relationship with them. And when he read the outline, he was like, are you fucking with me with this raccoon thing? I was like, what are you talking about? He was like, you didn't put this in there messing with me? I was like, no, not at all. So because of that, when we finally meet that hell raccoon, his name is Marty, named after Mike Martz. And I go out of my way to make him as creepy as, but he clucks and like squeaks like a dolphin, just because I think that's really fucking creepy, and I wanted to creep Mike out, so. So yeah, anyway, that's how comics are made sometimes.
We should all get like raccoon hats.
Oh yeah, we're gonna make plushies for sure.
Great, well thanks Donnie, we'll come back to a lot of other fun stuff. And so we're gonna go a little bit out of order here to highlight some of our other guests here on the panel. We have the great Phil Hester there on the end. Phil, if you want to tell us a little bit about both your Aftershock titles, both Shipwreck and Bloodlister, and a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, two comics to talk about. Well, I'll talk about Shipwreck because that's been out the longest, and people probably consume the most of it. And that's a book I'm drawing that Warren Ellis writes, and it's inked by my friend Eric Astor, and it's colored by Mark Ingwood as well, in a very kind of flat, non-literal coloring style that Warren and I really wanted to pursue for this project. But it's, when I describe it to people, I sort of describe it as Warren Ellis is the prisoner. So it's sort of absolutely this existential kind of horror story, but it's got, like all Warren's things, it's got a hard sci-fi underpinning to it. And as the series goes on, and as you delve further on into it, the sci-fi stuff starts to come to the fore a little bit. So it's purposely confounding and disturbing, and it never stops being disturbing. That continues. But it's less confusing as it goes on, and you pick up a little bit more of the sci-fi elements of the story. And it's a lot of fun. It's like the most fun I've had drawing a book in probably a decade. Because it's mostly takes place in a desert, which is awesome for me. No background. But everyone's very bedraggled. I also like drawing that. And everything's very stark and gaunt and wasted. And that's sort of in my wheelhouse as an artist.
You're already known.
Yes. and that's a joy to work on. And I'm sad that it's going to come to an end. But it's a great series. And it's a very satisfying, like, 6-issue chunk to read. And the second title we're talking about is Blood Blister, which is a horror book of mine that I'm writing that the great Tony Harris is drawing. So, you know, even if you find the story's terrible, and you won't, but even if you do, come for the Tony Harris art. And it's, I know there are a lot of possession stories out there in the world, and but they all sort of follow familiar paths. They're usually like really steeped in Catholic doctrine and Catholic lore, and the victim of the possession is usually innocent. And I wanted to flip a lot of that around and have a character that had no religious background. His family has a Jewish religious background, and whose possession is well earned. He deserves everything he's getting. I wanted to play with the idea that the demons that possess people are sort of gestate inside you. You know, you birthed that character. I mean, you birthed that demon inside of you with your actions. And if you follow other things I've written, like Deep Sleeper or The Coffin or even The Darkness, I always try to bring like a familial element into the story. So he's got a family that he's estranged from, but that's sort of his North Star to try to reclaim his soul and work his way back from this self-induced demonic possession he's got. And it's also super gross. Gets grosser all the way through.
That's family book, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Issue 2 of Bloodluster and issue 4 of Shipwreck are both at the printers right now.
Yeah.
They actually make them out the same week.
Yeah, first Wednesday, man.
First Wednesday night, so we have a full Esther week.
Yeah.
Celebration. Yeah.
That's okay. I'm having fun here. Yeah.
Great. Thanks, Phil. Again, we'll have more from you as we go. So next up, the great Adam Glass. And we've got two titles currently, Rough Riders and the upcoming The Normals. So Adam, want to chat about those?
Yeah, I will talk about Rough Riders first and foremost. I'm a history buff, and even though I look like an NFL lineman, inside my heart beats a nerd. And I just have always loved history, and especially loved Harry Houdini, and been fascinated by Teddy Roosevelt. So this idea of like taking all these characters out of boxing, so Jack Johnson, to take all these characters and put them into a story and sort of tell this, you know, altered reality, you know, yet history, like I try to include, I'd say, we were asking last night, Mike Z was asking me, and I said, yeah, it's about 75 historically true. Outside of the day, all these people got together and had this adventure. they're a super team. Outside of that, I really stick to the facts. So exploring these characters and being able to sort of present them to a whole new audience has been super cool, super exciting. Really love it. I've learned a lot, too, as I've researched it. It's a really fun book. Like, I didn't know what a badass Annie Oakley really was in real life. I mean, she was like a mutant. She never missed. I mean, she really was unbelievable. She traveled with the Indians in the Wild Bill show. Geronimo just called her Little Miss Sure Shot, and they thought she was possessed. They just never saw anybody shoot like that in their life. And another quick, interesting little quidbit about her was William Randolph Hearst had printed an article about a woman named Annie Oakley who was arrested for prostitution in Chicago. He printed it knowing that it wasn't her, but that it would sell papers, and she proceeded to sue him for the next 7 years using her own money. And she took him on in a time where women did not do that, and he had to not only pay her all the money back, but apologize publicly, and Hearst never forgave her for that. But her honor and her word and her name meant something to her, so she's quite a character. So putting all these characters together, telling all these stories with them has really been actually one of the most creatively fun things that I've ever had a chance to do. And then the flip of that is The Normals is really, you know, for a better part of the word, it's about my fears. I am very blessed to have a beautiful, wonderful family. And so this idea kept sort of hitting in my head. I remember sort of driving the car one day, and that Talking Head song finally made sense to me, you know. This beautiful house with your beautiful wife, and you know, how'd you get here? And I'm like, yeah, how the fuck did I get here? And the idea that I would lose all that. So I sort of put that through the lens of a science fiction story. And the idea that you turn around and you basically have this life, and then what if it wasn't real? What if like everything basically, spoiler alert, was a program, and that you really weren't who you thought you were? And it's really about a family that finds out, you know, a father who at first thinks something's wrong with his son, then comes to learn that there's something wrong with all of them, that they're all robots. And sort of like that their life has basically been a program. And so, you know, what do you do all of a sudden? How much would you fight to keep that together? It might be a program to them, but to you, it's real. You know, so what would you fight to do, and what would you do to keep your family together, and how far would you go? That's really what The Normals is about.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, we've been saying this about a lot of our different series, but there may be a special treat again if you come on by the Aftershock booth afterwards, and we're excited for what we can share on The Normals. Great, so to move on.
The Normals will be out in 3 weeks or so.
Mr. Joe Pruitt.
That would be me. The series I write for Black Eyed Kids, Aftershock, issue 12 comes out Wednesday, or if you're lucky, today at the Aftershock booth. So yeah, I'm the owner's running title here, so I'm pretty proud of that. Basically, this is based on the urban legend of the Black Eyed Children. If you don't know that, I'll just deliver real quick. It's pretty spooky. I was just trolling around Facebook one day and saw some like top 50 urban legends for 50 states. It's a lesson rest of me. And, well, like Iowa, I think, Bill, had Black Eyed Children. I was like, what the hell is that? And that's what I look into. So I'm going to write a story about it. So I did a little bit of research, and then I just took it off and made it home. I do have a new friend. He was a paranormal researcher who actually wrote a book called Black Eyed Children. He sent me a copy of it, which I won't read yet because A, it'll probably scare me. And B, I don't want to be, you know, influenced by the real life story, so I'm just trying to do my own as well. But when I finish the series, I'll go sit down and read it because I do want to read it, but I'll read it during the day. But it's basically, you know, these creepy little kids with black eyes who nobody knows what they are. Some people think they're aliens, some people think they're demons, or possessed children, or whatever, and this is my take on it, so.
Very cool, and most of you might already know, Joe Pruitt is also our Chief Creative Officer and our publisher, and so I've already mentioned this a few times over the show, but he does not sleep because of the many, many hats he wears. Great, so we have some quick summaries of each one of these series that these really talented individuals are working on, and we're going to dive into a few questions from the Aftershock side, and later on, of course, go to Q&A for you guys. Before we do that, I just want to highlight some of the 2017 launches, some of the stuff we've touched upon. I'm going to do that by actually starting with highlighting another talent, Mr. Garth Ennis. Most of you may already know that he did a mini-series with Aftershock called Dreaming Eagles. We're really excited about that, World War II, really you know, profound story that Garth always wanted to tell, and that was really amazing. And then we continued the conversation with Garth, and we're really excited to announce something you may have heard about called Jimmy's Bastards. It's in the same vein as Garth's The Boys and Preacher, so this kind of goes more of this satirical, kind of adult aspect, serious telling. Joe, you want to add a little bit more to what Jimmy's Bastards is all about?
It's not all ages.
Yes, it's. Well, Jimmy's Bastards, basically it's a take on a well-known secret agent you might know about. And he's had a lot of fun around the world. And he's got a lot of unknown children left behind. And basically, they're not very happy about daddy, and they're coming to meet him for the first time. I just said that.
Aftershock has a lot of books about, like, fucked up kids.
That is a very good segue to say that Jimmy's Bastards is launching the same week as Father's Day. That's awesome. And the other fun thing is, actually, if any of you are watching Preacher Season 2 premieres also the same week, so we've got this really Garth and Daddy week.
Work it out.
And if you're in New York that week, Garth will be doing a signing at Midtown Comics for Father's Day.
That's right. So Dad and Son, it's your time. Great. And so to highlight some of the other 2017 launches, we've already launched, and hopefully some of you got a chance to check out two recently, World Reader and Eleanor and Egret. World Reader, really exciting title for us. We actually have a C2 exclusive at the booth.
No, we don't. It's actually sold out.
Oh, okay. We no longer have the C2 exclusive of World Reader, but we do have the regular copy of number one, so you get the story.
And we have the C2 exclusive of Elmer Leader number one.
We do.
Okay. So that song.
Great. World Reader, written by Jeff Loveness, who's actually a writer on Jimmy Kimmel Live, as well as had experience writing Crute. It's a really interesting story, really deep. With amazing art by Wando, who you may know is doing, who did Atmosphere and Rise, an American Monster for us, really just incredible artists. And Elmer Leader, just like Joe mentioned, do have, we still have it, I'm not sure about the end of my sentence, but we still got the C2E2 variant cover. Written by John Lehman, who made most of you might know for writing Chew for Image. Really.
Boo. Aww. No, John's one of my best friends, and I wanted to get back to him that I was talking shit about on a panel. Boo. That book's awesome.
Well, good fun. And then, of course, the amazing Sam Keith, who's had just an incredible career.
Yeah.
Most people don't remember that he actually co-created Sandman with Neil Gaiman. But I mean, the Max is just one of the best series ever, and he's working on Batman and Green, just incredible. And so this is just, you know, a great to see these two together, because it's just their sense of humor and the interest here is great. We're going to chat a little bit about Normals, of course, Mr. Adam Glass, and we want to highlight that Dennis Calero is doing the artwork, and this very nice image here, which is one of our variant covers, is by Elizabeth Twork. Elizabeth has actually done some really great stuff for us too, including...
Yeah, a bunch of variants for baby teeth that are all really, really awesome. But they're gorgeous.
Exactly. We also additionally have Pestilence, which we haven't mentioned yet, written by the always a gentleman, Mr. Frank Thierry. You want to tell us a little bit about Frank Thierry, Joe? I think you can.
Frank is one of a kind personality. I don't think I can say anything else without offending him.
All right, great. And covers by Tim Bradstreet, that's just doing awesome. These amazing ones. You see here issue number one. Issue number two is just really, really detailed. I can't believe it. And then the whole team is just really talented and really excited about this book, which is basically asking the question, what's the exact question from Pestilence, Joe?
Well, it's basically like the plague, but before the like the plague wasn't really what they tell you it was, but it was the first zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
All right, and we already described Jimmy's Bastards a bit, Garth Ennis. I have to say the Russ Braun artwork is so detailed that it's really just amazing to see it kind of come all together. And again, not necessarily for the kids, but maybe some of the older sons to bond with their dads. We already chatted about Baby Teeth quite a bit. Tanya Kane's doing a great job. Gary Brown on art. Last, you may have heard, last Wednesday we just announced Unholy Grail by amazing writer Colin Bunn. We may know it right now to be X-Men Gold. I am confused, Gold, Blue.
What are those called?
One of those X-Men.
amongst many, many, many other incredible books that he actually has underneath his belt. And Mirko Kolak is doing the artwork, and you may have actually seen some of the previews online, just super detailed, and this is a really fun book. Joe, do you want to also describe a little bit?
There's nothing fun about this. But yeah, Mirko's artwork is so amazing. We did the preview before, we just did the pencils, because we don't want to, we want everybody to see how great, what a great job he's doing on it. Holy Grail is basically, it's to say it's a dark King Arthur. So let's take the Arthurian myths and twist it around a little bit.
Or lock it.
Okay, lock it, whatever.
All right, so I just had this slide up while we start off our aftershock here, Q&A here up here first. Here's about creators here. I'm gonna ask, what is the biggest inspiration for the specific title you have for Aftershock? Is there some movie, is there some other comic, is there a prose book?
My Children.
Oh, it's actually kind of true, Black Eyed Kids.
Joe's Children.
Yeah, two Joe's Children. Yeah, two Joe's. But anybody can answer.
I guess since, well, we just go down the line, I guess. Baby Teeth, so I'm a big, big fan of, there's that one TV show about that girl who who killed vampires out in California that ran out for a long time.
Yeah, I think I heard about that.
She had like a little group of friends and stuff. Is that my favorite book in the world?
It's like Mummy.
Yeah, something like that. I'm a huge fan of that. And so like as far as tone, Baby Teeth shares a lot in common with that. And actually, you know, in that show, you know, she had this like, you know, she at the age of 16, she had her kind of life stolen away from her because of this prophecy where she was the one, she was a slayer, and she had to kill all these vampires and stuff. And it's kind of fun to kind of flip it up a little bit and have Sadie, who's the lead character of our book, have her childhood kind of taken away from her because she gives birth to what will essentially, what is supposed to be the like harbinger of the apocalypse. At the same time, though, the baby's just, he's just adorable. Like, he's not, everyone keeps on telling her that he's like the king of bones and ash and shit. She's just like, yeah, I guess. He's just like an infant, like, you know. And so there's like two camps in the book, one of them which is trying to kill this baby, and then another group that is trying to put this baby on a throne and like usher in the apocalypse. But that's all like, it's all like kind of trappings all around this main story of this girl, Sadie, trying to deal with everything. And I don't think it's a surprise at all that like, just recently in my life, like 2 years ago or so, my brother had a kid. And so all of a sudden I have this like baby in my life and everything. And that's why I started to write some of the other books that I've done. I've been writing a lot about family because all of a sudden I have someone in my family that I like. Because he's two and he hasn't pissed me off yet or done anything, you know. So I don't know. I've been talking a lot about that, and I have a lot of aunts and uncles in my books that are badasses because I am those things now. I mean, I'm an uncle, I'm not an aunt yet.
Give it time.
Yeah, but there's a character in Baby Teeth, Heather, who's Sadie's older sister, who like of all the books that I've done, maybe like just like the meanest, like just fucking sociopath like person, but she loves Sadie, like, and she will protect her. But it's just like she just like casually sells heroin and stuff. It's like soups cash. It takes place in Salt Lake City, which is an awesome place to be 16 and pregnant. And also a great place for the, you know, harbinger of doom. Yeah, man, things go down so hard in that book. And so as far as influences, like, I always like to tell retailers that you could put it on the racks next to, like, a Paper Girls, you know, kind of like a larger event, but viewed through like a bunch of people who have no fucking earthly clue how to deal with this thing, but are just like kind of binded together by friendship. It kind of has a similar tone to that, but it's like cooler or whatever.
Yeah, so to recap, again, these are the inspirational aspects to what Donnie's writing about. Number two, kids don't do drugs.
Right. Just learn how to do drugs right.
Great. Anybody else want to share what sort of their inspirations were for their Aftershock series?
I don't know. I think it's, if you follow the stuff I've written before, you can see a pretty clear through line between my earliest stuff I've written, like The Coffin and Through Deep Sleeper, and up to Blood Blister, and sort of all in that same universe where, and I was talking to Donnie last night about how most horror doesn't scare me because I'm not scared for myself. You know, now that I have a family, that's, you know, I'm scared for my family, and I'm scared for their ultimate fate. So, but at the core of that, what I'm really afraid of is betraying my family. Like, not like through infidelity or something like that, but just letting them down, not being a good example to my son or my daughter, or not being able to provide for those people. Those are all things, all this toxic stew that goes into being an American male. And so I have that sort of, that large fear of failing, and Bloodluster is sort of that writ large that manifests as an actual physical failing in this guy's body. So all these mistakes he's made come back and haunt him, you know, in his, what he thought was a perfect body. And it's sort of like, you know, every horror thing I write is like secretly a Christmas carol. It's secretly like a chance to get it right, you know? And so this guy's got it. He thinks it's a curse, but it's actually a blessing because it's a chance for him to try to right the ship that he's on. And as far as shipwreck goes, artistically, my inspiration for that are down to two fantastic South American artists that I've loved since I was a kid. Alberto Breccia and Jose Munoz, both fantastic artists that really deal with high contrast, exploratory kind of art. So if you like shipwreck at all, you should definitely go look for some Jose Munoz comics, especially in Sinner, which is being reprinted by IDW.
Not to talk about another company,
you know. IDW is reprinting Sinner, and you should, anybody who reads comics on any level should seek Sinner out.
So I just want to ask you, like, just as if no one else is here, I just want to talk about Frank Bill. One of the books that I'm doing at Image was like directly inspired by, like, I had kind of a profound health issue.
Yeah.
Like 2 years ago, yeah. It came out the other side of it. Like, I'm fine now, but at the time it like really looked like I was not gonna be okay.
Right.
And came out the other side of it really having some things to talk about. I can't help but be struck by what you just described and what you...
Yeah, blood blisters definitely a case of that, because I got really sick a couple of years ago. I congestive heart failure. I used to be much bigger. If anybody knows me, I used to be a much bigger person. And part of my recovery was losing a lot of weight. And but I had this moment, like, that's the ultimate. I was talking about failing my family. Checking out on them early is sort of the ultimate.
That's why I asked, because I felt that same way.
And also, I was at the first time in my life where my body felt like my enemy, and I never had that happen before. And it happens to everybody eventually. Everybody's body. Exactly. So, especially when you get old and creaky.
I'm not even old like you guys, dude. I'm fucking young and hot. I'm falling apart. I'm hanging out while you fucking joke.
Don't try to keep up with the comments, bro.
The best quote you've ever given me. Don't try to keep up, kid.
But everybody deals with that. Like, and also, I dealt with in the course of shipwreck. I started shipwreck with my own corneas, and I finished shipwreck with two dead people's corneas. I had cornea transplants in both eyes, and everybody deals with not being able to do what they love physically at some point. Athletes all have to. I think athletes, nobody explores this like aspect of their lives enough. But like, that's a fantastic. They have to go through this incredible journey, usually in their 20s and 30s. That most people don't do until they're about to die, which is you can't do what you were put here to do anymore.
Yeah.
And as an artist, I was dealing with my eyes. I can't draw anymore, and that's my central to my identity. So that plays into blood blister a lot as well.
Yeah.
So now that my therapy session is over,
so now my shallow ass has to follow that. I was going to actually say, listen to both of you guys, having a pedigree in horror, having done Supernatural for 5 years, it probably would have behooved me to continue with that, but instead, like an idiot, I decided to do other things that inspired me, and I spoke to earlier, not just the love of history, but listening to both of you guys, I think you're either writing your fears or you're writing the things that inspire you. So my books are really, Rough Riders is my inspiration, my dreams, all that stuff. And then I think The Normals is very much my fears. And like you said, all the difference.
It's scary, too. I mean, it's scary.
Yeah.
Dreams are scary,
too. Yeah, dreams could be scary, too. But simply just what I think you were trying to ask in the beginning, Mike Z, at least the way I heard it, was like, so like what not only inspired you, but like the covers. So for Rough Riders, I always was in love this picture of the Wild Bunch, the Hole in the Wall gang, that they took a black and white sepia tone photo. So when I saw that picture, I turned around, and the original cover that was up there a minute ago was the cover that I did for it. So right there. That definitely, I always saw that cover in my head, and that picture in my head, and that turned that into that cover. But yeah, I mean, just to sum it up, I do think that we're always either writing the things we love, the things we hate, the things that scare us. We're basically pretty simple animals. Thank you. Joe, you wanna
share?
You guys are so deep.
Don't tell us you're scared of kids.
That's
why he's scared.
I'm just gonna spooky and cool. Nothing really big to it. I mean, I was a big X-Files fan, so like, I think that's why I found like a kids go living in urban legends and creepy things out there. And as I said, I do have six kids, so I can look at my kids and go, "What if you guys are all possessed?" The ironic thing is, if you've read like my kids number one, which I hope every single person here has, if you haven't, come out and do it, I'll give you a free copy of the preview book. The scenes in the first issue where the character, the son, Michael, starts becoming a black eyed kid. And no more in my prayer is for him. My son, and don't tell him I'm telling you guys this, because that would be very embarrassing, is a sleepwalker. And his name is also happens to be Michael. The sleepwalk scenes in the first issue are actually real ones that he did in real life, where he's at a friend's house one night and his friend's mom comes in late and he's like looking out the window and it's in the book I have, Michael looking out the window, they're coming. He actually did that. Same exact words, they're coming. And she's like, who's coming? They're coming. You know? So I said, that's pretty spooky. And then there's another scene in the book where he's done some naughty things with a knife as he's becoming a black eyed kid. And he stands at the top of the doorway, the hallway, the stairs, whatever, and mom and stepdad look up and he's standing with a knife. He goes, "One more must die." My son said that. He went to the top of the stairway, he's through the doorway, and I wasn't there, luckily, because I'm hardly freaked out. And he looks down, my wife looks up, and he goes, "One more must die." I'm like, "What the hell are you dreaming?" So I said, so instead of being a concerned dad, I'm writing this stuff down. So that's a cool thing. The other thing that it's not in the book, but he came down one night, he just walked down and he's standing in the living room, he's looking at our kitchen table there, and he's like doing this. And they're like, "Why are you doing it?" Because he doesn't know what he's doing. And he's like, "Don't you see them? The eyes, they're staring at me at the table." And I'm like, "Wow, that's after I wrote the first issue, I couldn't put it in." And then he just walked out the front door. So he doesn't really do that much anymore, but he'll come down, get water, and we can tell he's sleepwalking. We're like, "No, at least to a point we kind of like, no, what are you doing?" He just sit down and stand there for a minute. "Michael, yeah, are you awake?" "Yeah." "No, but he's not." Yeah. And then eventually you can just see him clear up, and he starts looking at this. "Do you know you're sleepwalking?" "What am I doing out here? You know, I'm going to go back to bed."
So you're just transcribing basically.
Yeah, transcribing. I'm not a writer.
You're like, "Michael, go to bed. He's got a deadline."
He's just like scrambling, writing all this down.
So this is all happening right when I started putting like my kids together. So he actually was a big help with that first issue. That was my inspiration.
Well, it's interesting because I keep making come back to this, but there is a lot of father-son, you know, aspects to a lot of books, or at least parent-child, family, was brought up a lot. And not to put you guys on the spot, but these are, you know, very interesting stories. And some of the stuff is like, you know, autobiographical graphic novels sound like could be very interesting if you guys are cool with these types of like stories being out there. Okay. Joe obviously doesn't mind at all with all.
Don't tell my son. He hates when I talk about. But like, you know, Phil says, and part of the stories is the fear that you lost your family or bad as well for the normals, because the minor character, like a kid, so the dad loses him to evil. So what would happen if you're getting, you know, you lost your child? This is me playing with that as well. So.
All right, another question for you guys. It's pretty open-ended, so again, feel free whoever wants to chime in first. I'm curious, how did you break into the comic book industry, or if you just want to share one of your stories about the early years of working on comics, is there anything that kind of sticks out?
It's all Polaroid cameras. That would instantly develop compromising positions.
Well, I'll start because I'm the oldest. When I started in comics, it was about when the Turtles blew up as a comic book for the first time, and then suddenly everybody with a credit card wanted to be a publisher. So we went from, you know, like 6 or 7 publishers to about 30 publishers overnight. And if you could hold your pencil the pointy side down, you could get work as an artist. and I could do that. That's why I started. That's how I still just work.
Yeah.
But I actually started during that black and white boom when I was in college and sort of like been inching my way up that ladder ever since.
So that would have been what, 89?
My first published thing is I actually started in 87.
Wow.
Actually, I started in 86. It didn't come out.
When you were 12.
It didn't come out till 87.
What was the title?
Yeah, you will never know.
It's called the internet. I actually was, during their last writer's strike, which was 10 years ago, I was on line with a guy named Mike Benson, and we were walking the line, and he was writing Moon Knight at the time, and just got a new book, and he was, you know, just both comic book fans, we're just talking comics, and both writers, and he was like, well, I'm doing this new book, and I'm just having a hard time with it, and we're just pitching back and forth, and you know, after about 2 weeks in line doing this, he's like, want to write it with me? I was like, what? Serious? And next thing I know, Axel Alonso called me from Marvel. And, you know, like I said, I was reading comics until I was 4 years old, so it was a dream come true. And that was sort of my break in, and that was Deadpool Suicide Kings. And that was how I got in.
I broke in wanting to be an artist from 89. I just got out of college. I kind of dropped out of comics through college. I kind of discovered girls and alcohol, and I ended up running for one or the other. So comics went away. But when I actually had a steady girlfriend towards the end of my years, I turned back in because I had to go spend all the money. But I would go visit her hometown. She would be working, so I would drive around town and find a comic shop, and I'd probably go back and read things I missed, like Watchmen and more Swamp Thing, and a book called Flaming Carrot, which was coming out from an And so I found out that Bob actually graduated, and we both went to the University of Georgia. He was in Atlanta, I was in Athens still, and I noticed that he used his assistants, and he credited them in his comics. I said, this is so cool, I love this book, and he's local, uses assistants, so let me reach send a letter and see what happened there. So I sent him a note, and hey, look, I'm just graduating college. I'm not sure what I want to do right now. I'm an English major. I'm a big fan of your book. I think it's great. I see you use assistants. So by any chance, would you need an intern or something like that to come work for me for free just so I can learn the business and learn the ropes? And surprisingly, 3 weeks later, he called me up. Took me to meet him at the Batcave, which he called his house. And that'd be a secret. Don't tell me about it. I mean, I'm going to offer jobs as a paying assistant for him. So I broke in, like I said, wanted to be an artist and sort of get some background and learning how to letter and transcribing his notes. Bob liked to walk around with handheld tape recorders and record everything he said. So basically, so I would sit there transcribing for him. And when Bob would like yawn, he wouldn't stop talking. So I'd be like, hold on, what? What does it say, Bob? You know? And he'll be listening, unless you hear a flush. I mean, he talks everywhere he goes, apparently. So I did that for a couple of years, start from the book, getting some comic credits, and then start meeting his friends, you know, the Alan Moores of the world, the Brian Bollins, and, you know, and start making my way. And it's all you know a lot of times. So a few years later, I started being a writer. And actually, I was at a little place with Tundra, with Paul Jenkins as my editor. And he was an editor at Tundra, which is kind of funny. I think he was my first editor. Then Tender kind of went belly up, and I ended up over Caliber Comics. And sort of right there, this sort of book called Negative Burn, which I edited for a long time, and became an editor somehow. The next time I'm the talent scout for Caliber, bringing in, you know, the Mobius and the No Gamers and the Alan Moores of the world. And it was like a place where you used to start your career and move on. So that's where I met Phil. But then my goal was to make it a place where you've already got your career coming and you can find stuff. So I was lucky enough to work with Michael Phil and, you know, the Bendis and David Max, who were coming up with us at the same time. And I like to say, you know, I was the first guy to publish like John Cassidy, put him together with the Warren Ellison project, which never happened, but they went on to do Planetary together. So I'll take a little credit for that. And did that, and then, you know, somehow another thing for Marvel, and now I'm here. So dreams happen, but you only if you make them.
I was a retailer in Austin. I ran a bunch of comic book stores in Austin. and then I ran them into the ground. Nice, like you do. And I really loved being in that environment. I like learned how to read on comics when I was a kid. My dad taught me how to read using comics, and that was in 2007. I started running those comic book stores, and I was a part of the industry. Retailers are kind of the center of this whole thing, you know. And when I ran those shops into the ground, I really wanted to stay in the industry in any capacity that I could. I didn't have enough money to open up my own store, you know. So I'm a decent artist. I can draw, and I was a pretty good sculptor. And so I ended up getting a scholarship for sculpting and painting to the SCAD, you know, the Savannah College of Art. So I went out there, and then I was in classes. Interior comics classes with guys like Trad Moore and Jeff Shaw, and so I quit immediately upon seeing those guys' works. And then I just didn't like I could draw like if I had a month to do a cover, I could do a pretty good cover. You know, it's not going to be anything near like what Phil can do or anything. But like
a lot of artists do that. I mean, a ton of artists start that way. I mean, sorry, right?
Writers, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, start out.
Well, yeah, I think that going through that college and having to learn how to ink a page and color a page and lay out a page and learning every aspect of it has been really great. But then right around that time, I had a writing class, and I had a professor that was very encouraging. And I was never like the writer kid. Like, I'd never written anything in my life. But he was really encouraging, and so I started putting together story ideas and stuff. And then I took a summer off, and I was an intern at Marvel. And when you intern at Marvel in the editorial camp, you're really it's like writing boot camp, because they are making you write all day, every day, write recaps and stuff, and you know all that stuff. And then so right after that, I started making ash cans of this dumb comic that I made. And I started pitching it on the floor, and somehow the ash can got on to the president of Dark Horse's desk. He liked it. He published it in Dark Horse Presents. And then after that, that came out in 2011. And then my first series came out in 2013. And Baby Teeth is my seventh series since then, which is rad and weird and surreal that I get to do it. But actually, 2017 is like the 10 year of the 10 years of me being in the industry, which is
overnight success.
Everyone keeps on saying that in these interviews, and they're just like, "Where'd this kid come from?" And I was like, "Man, I've been here for that's fine."
That's great. It's really good to hear. Actually, I'm going to share a very, very quick story just about myself, just because this was sort of like a game changer. And I don't know if anybody out there remembers Wizard Magazine, but I was an avid reader, collector, whatever you want to call it, back in the day. It's probably about 12 years old, maybe 13 years old, and they had an art section. To Phil's point about, you know, kind of starting out and, you know, trying stuff out, I submitted a piece of art that was basically a mix of Jeff Smith's Bone meets Alex Ross's Marvels. I had a subscription, obviously 13 years old. My parents asked, get a subscription in the mail. Issue 49, I'm literally just flipping through it. No one contacted me. No one had any reason to really contact me.
That's the wizard way.
There you go. There it is. Somewhere in the middle of the comic, I'm just sitting there flipping through, and there's my artwork, was first prize. And I was like, holy shit, this is pretty cool. I had no idea that was going to happen. And that's where it was like, okay,
what did you win?
I won a Jerry Ordway original Shazam piece of artwork.
Oh, wow. Oh,
shit. Yes, I still have that.
Is it for sale?
No, it's not.
Wow. I want to call it.
Something else that was a really prized possession for me, was a big fan of Batman the Animated Series, and it was Mad Love by Bruce Timm, Paul Dini, Alan Burnett, all signed by them. It was just incredible. I had no idea it was going to happen, and that was kind of a game-changing thing.
So he decided to quit being a Chippendale dancer and becoming...
Exactly, a 13-year-old Chippendale dancer.
Yeah, 100%.
Definitely, yeah. I know we don't have too much time left, but I want to see if there was any other questions out there for these talented individuals here.
I have one directly for your chief creative officer. obviously, you guys are gearing toward a certain age, structure, and readership, which is the prime market. But down the road, are you planning any, you know, any all ages or broader material?
Sure. How old are you?
About your age.
Okay. We're aiming for that 13 to 50 audience. we're not actively saying we're a mature readers only company. It just says so we want good stories, and a lot of stories we've gotten so far have been that vein. But no, we're definitely open to doing more all ages stuff as well.
Rough Riders is all ages.
Mm-hmm. You know, Rough Riders, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess Rough Riders is all ages.
Baby about it. Talking about it and raising cool shit.
Love Blister definitely is all ages.
You have very bad parents.
I'd like to do more. Some all ages books. I had some meetings this week with some libraries and school systems. I'm like, and why am I going to meet with you? Because they don't have anything really to sell them beyond Rough Riders and Pinot Super Zero. And then probably.
Oh, Dirty Bird.
Yeah, and Dirty Eagle. But I'd like to have more options like that.
Yeah, to add up on that too, I just wanted to mention that, you know, obviously very creator driven, fantastic creators. So, you know, if there's a creator that comes out with all ages, I think, you know, the whole team is going to be excited.
Yeah, Jeff Smith, Bobby Bone, I would take that.
Yeah. Other question?
He was next right here. Okay.
Yeah, I'm curious. It seems like a lot of creators have, there's a lot of options out there for things to publish. I'm curious if you guys comment on why Aftershock, at least for these series.
Because I'm a founder of the company, that's why I'm here.
And because they said yes.
And again, it goes back to the Polaroids that I have.
Yes. Well, okay. I will say that outside of image, it's probably the most creator-driven.
Absolutely.
Yes. I've ever been involved in it. And a lot of fans and readers don't know this, but at image, you're sort of a lot on your own for a lot of this stuff, you know, in terms of promotion and paying your staff and all that stuff. That's sort of on you. And if you're a huge name, you can swing that. But if you're not a big, gigantic needle mover, you need some, or if your mind just doesn't go to dealing with distributors and shops, you need a support infrastructure. And Aftershock's as close as you can get to image, but with that sort of editorial and promotional infrastructure, and, you know, a kind of a living wage while you work on those things.
Yeah.
So it makes a big difference in a lot of creators' lives.
Aftershock also has seemed more to me that they invest, they approve people and not really plots first. Like they seek out talent that they know that they can trust, and then kind of just let the reins off. You know, once you know Lee and Mike and I got to know each other, and I started turning in baby teeth into it. It's just this open kind of really cool environment of just like, what kind of crazy ideas do you have that, like, you know, you don't talk with anybody about because you think that they're too weird or too crazy, because, you know, it's one of those things that, like, I've worked for companies in the past where I've had to pitch on things, and I've done three or four books with them. And they were like, yeah, we just don't really know how this idea will be, like, you know, executed. I'm just like, I mean, you think I'm going to forget how to read or how to write comics? Like, it's going to sound a whole lot like the other stuff I did, you know. And with Aftershock, it's a very trusting environment. They even if they're, like, if Lee and Mike are like, that's a really, really fucking weird idea. I don't know how you're going to pull that off. They'll be like, go do it. And then, you know, they'll let you go and try some really weird stuff. It's been really cool.
Yeah, just to reiterate what I think everyone's saying here, I knew Mike Martz from my DC days writing Suicide Squad. I just always loved the world of him, and he's actually the reason I had to go to him, and I had not known him, and pitch him Harley Quinn for Suicide Squad, because DC Comics did not want her on the Suicide Squad. And so I went by and convinced him.
Really?
And of course now they say, oh, we do. No, you didn't. Somebody told me no three times. And Martz was the guy who helped me do that. So I always had a great relationship with him, and he had a great reputation, as did Joe. And these guys were all very, very artistic, friendly. And so when you go to a place that you know is like that, just like these guys said, and they're open to things and they're willing to talk about things, I mean, that's a dream come true. And I think we can all say this, we're all writing the books we want to write,
yeah,
versus writing books that we thought we wanted to write, but people are getting involved and messing them up. Every book that I put out with these guys is exactly the book I wanted to do. So that's the reason why.
there that is, I mean, because, and on both sides, because it's Mike Marks. Like, Mike Marks has edited some of the best books that have ever been made, you know? And so, you know, being able to have a direct line with Mike and be able to call him and run things by him and everything, and having that opinion that trusts you, that you can trust him, you know, it's fantastic.
Yeah, to just add upon that, and sort of on the staff side, you know, it's exactly the intention of Aftershock. You know, when it comes to Joe Pruitt, when it comes to Mike Marks, you guys talk about Lee Kramer, our president. You know, the idea is it's a little bit of guidance, it's a little bit of a soundboard, you know, really letting you guys shine, tell the stories you want to tell. But, you know, Aftershock is there to support that and to keep it, you know, you guys are already bringing in the quality and making sure that quality is consistent across all the talent. And that's why it's such a joy for, you know, for everyone on the staff side to work with you guys.
Well, and also we're missing the biggest thing. Also, guys who love comic books, you know, and yeah. Know them and love them and are into them and all that stuff. Not just people that, yes, everybody wants to make money, it's a business, but at the same time, real love for the comics. I totally feel that with these guys.
Yeah, and girls that love comics too. Mm-hmm. We have lots of female talent that's really excited to work with us, so it's good.
Hey, so you like comics?
Nice.
Nice.
I think we're out of time. We got the time signal.
Alrighty. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. Again, please come by booth 417. Actually, Lisa, I think, is going to have some stickers for you guys. And with those stickers, you just bring them back to the booth, and you're going to get something special. So thanks for your time, and hope to see you at the booth.
Thanks.